This is Wealth Wake Up on KGMI with Dick Donahue.
The opinions voiced in Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities offered through Cetera Advisor Networks, member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advice offered through CWM, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Cetera Advisor Networks is under separate ownership from any other named entity. Guests of Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are not affiliated with Cetera Advisor Networks, CWM, LLC, or Asset Advisors, LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. Thank you for listening. Okay, it's time to stop spending taxpayer dollars on Elon Musk and cronyism. From Enron to Bernie Madoff, at the end of every great American financial scandal, the totality of the perpetrator's greed seems to be matched only by the public's incredibly stupidity on how such a thing could have happened or been allowed to happen. And thanks to Elon Musk, there's a good chance we may all be asking this question again soon. The Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee have launched a probe into the tax incentives paid to solar companies, according to the Wall Street Journal. The committee probes, led by their respective Republican chairmen, Representative Kevin Brady of Texas and Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, have found an appropriate and disturbing target to begin this work. SolarCity, a solar installation company set to be purchased by Tesla Motors, is one of the seven companies named in the initial investigation. Already grossly subsidized, Musk's SolarCity has become an albatross of waste, fraud, and abuse of taxpayer dollars. As legitimate earnings and cash become even scarcer for SolarCity, its entanglement in the Tesla empire suggests that a drastic reckoning not only is imminent, but in fact emboldening Musk to become more outlandish and reckless. Notably, SolarCity is run by Musk's cousin, Lyndon and Peter Rive. During his chairmanship at SolarCity, Musk's family enterprises has taken in billions of taxpayer dollars in subsidies from both federal and local governments. But the subsidies and sweetheart deals were not enough, as losses and missed projections continued to mount. Ultimately, rather than endure the embarrassment of collapse and further damage to the public image of Musk and Tesla, the cousins conspired to have Tesla simply purchase SolarCity this year. The conditions of the deal screamed foul play. To say nothing, what sense it might make for the automaker to purchase a solar installation company, Tesla stockholders were being forced to absorb a failing, cash-burning company and pay top dollar to do so. And while cost-cutting and corporate restructuring should have been the priority for a company swimming in debt and burning through available cash, SolarCity, in fact, has been doubling down on the failed model of taxpayer support. The desperate thirst for handouts has manifested itself in some of the murkiest political waters imaginable. Thanks to Musk's cozy relationship with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, the state has granted at least $750 million of its taxpayers' money to SolarCity, building the company a factory and charging it only a dollar a year for rent. It would be hard to imagine such an operation would not be lucrative for its shareholders, and yet somehow SolarCity has never made a profit. It's not just in New York. It's this year's race for Arizona Corporation Commissioner, the state's public utilities overseers. Only one outside group funneled cash into the contest. All of the $3 million donated by that group, Energy Choice for America, came from SolarCity. The beneficiaries are candidates who have been signaled to their willingness to take part of the green machine that greases the skids for lucrative government subsidies. Burning through taxpayer dollars, buying elections, and expanding a network of crony capitalism has become so inherent to the SolarCity model that $3 million to a public commissioner's race, brazen though it may be, is only a drop in the bucket for Musk and SolarCity. In 2013 alone, SolarCity received $127.4 million in federal grants. The following year, in which it received only $342,000 from the same stimulus package, the revenues were just $176 million, and the company posted a net loss of $375 million. So despite an expansion of operation and claims to be the leader in the industry, SolarCity never has been able to survive without serious help from government subsidies and grants. The failure to responsibly turn taxpayer dollars into profitable renewable energy provider has led to SolarCity's collapse into the welcoming arms of Tesla. And with Tesla, SolarCity, in fact, might be right at home, compounding a disastrous shell game that Elon Musk is playing with government resources. It has been widely reported that among SolarCity, Tesla, and the rocket company SpaceX, Elon Musk's Confederacy of Interest has gotten at least $4.9 billion in taxpayer support over the past 10 years. This is almost half of Musk's supposed net worth, taken from the pockets of American citizens and put into companies that can only survive by cannibalizing each other, spending without end, and promising that success is always just beyond the horizon and yet never arrives. The American people are being taken on a ride by SolarCity, Tesla, and Musk. The ride is fueled by a cult of personality of Musk, and it costs billions of taxpayer dollars as he promises us not only the moon, but to harass the power of the sun and send us all to Mars. In the case of Enron and Bernie Madoff, in the end, the cheated victims wish to have woken up sooner to the hubris that enables such a downfall, or that at least regulators had pulled their heads out of the sand before the full impact of the collapse was realized. We've seen this story before, and we know how it ends. The congressional investigations underway not only are necessary, but a signal that more must be done, and soon. We may not be able to help Elon Musk stop himself from falling apart again, but we certainly shouldn't be the ones to pay for it. It's past time for the American people to stand up to Musk and demand that our legislators and other elected officials bring him back to earth before spending one more dollar of our money. He's wasted enough of it already. And this week in review, a little geopolitical tensions are on the rise. So we had the war of the words with North Korea and the United States. The U.S. inflation rises less than expected. The Venezuela Constituent Assembly declares itself superior. And South Africa's Zuma survives confidence vote. And the United Kingdom floats a trial balloon on divorce settlement. So global equities gave ground this week and intensified geopolitical concerns as tensions between North Korea and the United States ratcheted higher. Safe haven assets were in demand as investors stuck to in a risk-off posture. Bonds rallied, pushed the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note to 2.21% from 2.27% a week ago. Safe haven currencies such as the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen firmed, as did precious metals. Oil prices retreated modestly as West Texas Intermediate crude declined to $48.20 a barrel from $49 a week ago. Volatility is measured by the Chicago Board of Options Volatility Index, or VIX, rose considerably to 15.50 from 9.90 last Friday. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back after a short break.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up this Sunday morning. Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI. As a reminder, we're asset advisors located out on the Pacific Highway in Ferndale. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101. That's Ferndale 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Check out our website, assetadvisorsllc.net or wealthwakeup.com. Okay, on continuing here with the economic reports this week. Okay, North Korea threatens Guam with Trump's warning. U.S. President Donald Trump warned North Korea in no uncertain terms this week that his continued threats, if carried out, would be met with overwhelming force. North Korea, undeterred, announced that it was planning to target the water surrounding the U.S. territory of Guam with 4 missiles and that a plan would be ready within a matter of days. Trump responded by noting U.S. military plans are now locked and loaded should North Korea act unwisely. Earlier this week, intelligence assessments became public, revealing that North Korea has likely acquired the technological capability to miniaturize a nuclear warhead, making it deliverable by missile. North Korea recently tested a missile believed to have the range to reach parts of the United States. Tensions have risen further. In the wake of additional United Nations sanctions against North Korea, unanimously agreed upon by the UN Security Council, and the sanctions aim to cut North Korea exports by 1/3 and ban exports of coal, iron ore, and seafood. And we had muted U.S. inflation data. The consumer price index rose just 0.1% in July after not rising at all in June, the 5th straight month of below forecasted inflation figures. And while U.S. Federal Reserve has said it sees the recent decline in inflationary pressure as transitory, markets are not so sure. Futures markets forecast just a 40% chance of another rate hike before the end of the year. And the newly created Constituent Assembly this week in Venezuela declared itself supreme over all other branches of Venezuela's government. A growing list of governments, including the U.S., the European Union, and the Supranational Organization of American States, has declared the assembly illegitimate. The U.S. went so far as to sanction 8 individuals with roles in the body's formation, but has yet to sanction Venezuela's oil industry, which is the third largest global exporter of crude to the United States. And in South Africa, Jacob Zuma, the embattled president of South Africa, faced the 4th no-confidence motion of his presidency on Tuesday, the first voted on by a secret ballot. 201 votes were needed to remove Zuma, but the measure failed by a vote of 198 to 177 with 7 abstentions. And the United Kingdom opens the bidding war at 40 billion euro. So British negotiators appear to have floated a trial balloon in the press on the size of the divorce payment Theresa May's government would be willing to pay to leave the European Union. The Sunday Telegraph reported that the United Kingdom would be willing to pay $40 billion in euros, but only on condition that the payments come as part of the deal that included the future trade relationship with the EU. United Kingdom officials shot down the report as speculative, but it would appear to be a reasonable starting point for negotiations. EU officials have floated exit charge figures of between 50 billion euro and 100 billion euro. And as of the 9th of August, 447 of the S&P 500's index companies have reported earnings for the second quarter. Earnings expected to rise 11.9% compared to last year's 9.2% without energy. Revenues are up 5.1% versus the first second quarter of 2016, and they're up 4.1% if you exclude energy. Okay, a little bit more detail here. The CPI, Consumer Price Index, rose 0.1% in July, continuing the tame inflation that started in February. Consumer prices rose at a 3.6% annual rate in the 6 months ending in January, but are now down at 0.1% annual rate over the past 6 months. So what's changed? Well, energy prices declined substantially from mid-2014 through the start of 2016, then rose through much of last year. That rise helped push overall consumer prices up at a 3.6% rate in the 6 months ending in January. But with energy prices generally down since then, overall inflation has been quiet as well. Still, we think inflation is in a general rising trend. Prices rose 0.2% in the 12 months through July of 15, 0.8% in the 12 months through July of 16, and 1.7% in the last 12 months. Moreover, the acceleration in inflation has arrived despite oil prices being lower today than in 2015. Core prices, which strip out the volatile food and energy components, have shown steadily rising prices of late, increasing in 11 of the past 12 months. And within core inflation, a small subset of the categories have kept prices from reaching or exceeding the Fed's 2% inflation target. Cell phone service plans have declined 13.3% in the last year, while major household appliances are down 5.2% and vehicle costs are falling. But for the consumer, these falling prices, which are the result of technological improvements and competition, plus rising wages, mean increased spending power on all other goods, but it tempers inflation readings. Meanwhile, costs for medical care and rent continue to push overall consumer prices higher. So we expect rents to accelerate in the year ahead. As supply constraints get tighter in the housing market, we will expect inflation to trend towards 2% in the medium term, and we don't think that the gains to consumers from falling prices in select areas are reason to concern or a justification for the Fed to slow the pace of rate hikes. The best news in the report is the real hourly earnings rose 0.2% in July. The earnings are up 0.7% over the past year, up 2.6% annual rate over the past 6 months, and at a 3% annual rate in the last 3 months. Because the Fed believes in the Phillips curve, the trend of accelerating price and wage gains should have the Fed officials focusing more on the potential for inflation to rise faster than desired as the jobless rate continues to fall below their long-term target. That's why we expect the Fed to stick to their plan of starting to unwind the balance sheet while also raising rates one more time in 2017. We also had the producer price index come out this week, and it declined 0.1% in July, led lower by a 0.2% dip in services. Within the services sector, margins for retailers and wholesalers led the index lower, down 0.5% in July. Declining margins were broad-based, but were led by fuel retailers, chemical wholesalers, and auto retailers. Goods prices also ticked lower in July, with energy prices falling 0.3%. If you take out typically volatile food and energy sectors, and you're left with core prices, which also declined 0.1% in July, but have risen 1.8% in the last 12 months, very close to the 1% gain in overall producer prices. So in spite of the dip in prices in July, the trend is very close to the Fed's 2% inflation target. As a result, this data is unlikely to alter the Fed's view that further rate hikes are warranted, and with one coming later this year, and should soon announce the start of reductions in the size of the balance sheet. We see a similar pattern with prices further up the production pipeline, with a drop in prices in July for both intermediate processed and unprocessed goods, but with these goods up 3.5% and 5.2% over the last year, respectively. The Fed will keep all this in mind as it plans the path of monetary policy. News out on the Fed's other key area of focus, employment, showed that the initial jobless claims rose 3,000 for the week to 244,000. Meanwhile, continuing claims declined 16,000 to 1.95 million. It's early, but taking these together and considering the Amazon hiring surge suggests payrolls will be up in the neighborhood of 190,000 in August, a little faster than the 180,000 monthly average in the past year. Okay, give you a little quick short little blurb here. The SEC's Office of Investor Education and Advocacy, or OIEA, and its broker-dealer task force are warning that fraudsters are pretending to be government agencies, duping employees out of money. More than 5 million thrift savings plan participants and investors and other federal government employee retirement plans could be subject to the scam. So the agency put out some reminders of what to watch for. Among the tips, the TSP will never contact you by email, telephone, or mail, asking that you provide sensitive personal information such as your account number, Social Security number, password, or PIN. So another one of those security alerts running around out there. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up this Sunday morning. Anyway, we'll be back after a short break. Thank you for listening. Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. North Korea spooks everyone. As the isolated nation expands its ability to hit remote targets, the rest of the world is getting nervous, which finally bled to the financial markets. What does this all mean? Well, North Korea has been developing intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear warheads for decades. We negotiated with them several times during the Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama administrations to halt the process in exchange for goodies. They took the goodies and kept building missiles. So now they have them, although their ability to launch nuclear-tipped missiles is unconfirmed. The rogue state's latest threat is to use Guam, the United States territory and military outpost, as a target practice by shooting missiles away into the seas around the island about 20 miles from shore. Do we wait for that to happen? Investors took notice of the growing hostility this week and decided that it was time to cash some profits. Buy gold. Maybe it was the risk of war, or maybe it was the risk of a typical summer pullback. Whatever their motivation, investors around the world pulled money from equities and sought out safe havens. And the consumer price indexes, modest is up, we're up 0.1% last month. Inflation barely ticked up last month, and the year remains subdued at 1.7%. What does all this mean? Well, both headline and core inflation moved up 0.1% last month and rose 1.7% for the year. Easing home and auto prices are holding down inflation, giving consumers a break. That putting the Fed in a bind, how will they justify raising rates if they don't have higher wages and prices? As I said last month, I think the Fed will skip raising rates soon, probably by the end of the year, but they are instead going to focus on reducing its balance sheet starting in September. Soft inflation gives Fed officials breathing room to tackle one thing at a time. Credit card debt reaches an all-time high of $1.021 trillion. Student loan debt rose to $1.45 trillion, and car loans surpassed $1.13 trillion. What does this mean? Well, credit card debt is expanding, but on an inflation-adjusted basis, it's still less than it was just before the financial crisis. And if lenders like American Express and Visa end up with a default issue, well, it's their problem. The same goes for car loans. GM and Ford might be reaching down the socioeconomic ladder and lending to less creditworthy borrowers. But if they default, we'll have cheaper used cars because of the flood of repos. But bad student loan debt should grab your attention. We've added almost $1 trillion in just the last 10 years, and most of it is coming after 2007, when we were concerned about debt. If student loan debt borrowers default, it doesn't ding a private company. It falls right in the lap of the American taxpayer. And oil prices rise as inventory drops. U.S. inventory fell 6.5 million barrels last week, now sits 3.6% below the level of last year. What does this mean? Well, Americans are ending summer on a driving high note, with rig count in the U.S. appears to be leveling off after rising for most of the year. These factors, along with easing supplies, are driving up the price of oil. It doesn't help that the U.S. president is trading barbs with a nuclear-armed crazy guy. War fears drive up the price of energy. But it's worth remembering where we are, at less than half the cost of oil just a couple of years ago. If prices climb to the mid-50s, we'll see more U.S. rigs brought back online, which will eventually lower prices. And Americans aren't the only one who want to cash in on higher prices. OPEC oil production increased 32.87 million barrels per day in July, the highest monthly output this year and well above the group's target. It appears that several members, including the Saudis, aren't sticking to their production quotas. It's hard to see how oil prices will remain high if OPEC production climbs. And Macy's misses its earnings, stock drops 9%. The retailer, along with Dillard's, reported the latest in a string of disappointing quarterly earnings. What does this mean? Well, Dillard's dropped almost 14% after its earnings report, but that probably doesn't make the leaders of Macy's feel any better. The current trend of department stores reminds me yet again of the old line, a train wreck is slow motion, is still a train wreck. Anyone buying these stocks as a value play should remember that just because stock falls doesn't mean it can't fall further. Stay out of harm's way until these retailers figure out how to survive. And the Drudge Report goes black and white. Matt Drudge, purveyor of the website The Drudge Report, took down all color on his homepage in favor of shades of gray. What's it mean? Well, when asked why, Drudge replied that the world seems reminiscent of the roaring 20s and that it's what's old is new. So he wanted to reflect that feel on his site. Drudge isn't the first one to note the parallels. We've had many innovations changing our daily lives, naturally causing occurring in deflation, changing the way we work, and rapidly rising income inequality. Let's hope it doesn't end the same way. And this next week, the week of August 14th, brings reports of retail sales and housing starts and the industrial production, as well as the minutes of the last Fed meeting. Oh, Chicago. Chicago's America's dark financial star. The Windy City is famous for lots of things, including the biting winter breeze off of Lake Michigan and the blowhard politicians. Whether Chicago got its pet name from one or the other doesn't really matter. You know, the Windy City, since both fit. But soon, the place also called the Second City would be known as something else, the Municipal Black Hole. It's only a matter of when, not if, Chicago will consume itself financially and will start sucking in the wealth of anyone and anything connected to it, just as black holes in space eat the energy of nearby stars. It's easy to lay the blame on runaway pension liabilities, but uncommon to those cities and states across the country. But Chicago's trouble is deeper than most, and most recent decisions by the state of Illinois would only make it worse. The Fiscal Times rates over 100 municipalities based on their fiscal strength. Chicago is dead last. The city has little in reserves to cover unexpected expenses or a drop in revenue. Its general fund balance covers only 6.27% of its annual expenditures. Meanwhile, Chicago carries a lot of debt. Its long-term obligations are almost 300% of revenue. The city spends one-fifth of the budget covering required pension contributions, but it's still not enough. As of 2015, one of the city's largest pensions held just under 33% of what it needs to meet its obligations. The Municipal Employees Annuity and Benefit Fund held $4.7 billion in assets, but it owed $14.7 billion in benefits. Mayor Rahm Emanuel raised taxes to address some of the shortfall, but it won't right the ship. This pension, along with several others, will drag Chicago under. The mayor tried to curb pension benefits, but the courts beat him back. Illinois views public pensions as constitutionally guaranteed, so there will be no compromise. Beneficiaries can demand payments until the city's bank accounts run dry. And several states take this same stance, while others take a different view, which will lead to varying outcomes as pensions blow up around the country. After that, who knows? There's no problem in the bankruptcy code for states, or no provision in the bankruptcy code, I should say, for states, so all we can do is look to previous examples and see how things might go. When we look at Puerto Rico, currently the largest near-state plotting through near bankruptcy, it's ugly. Bondholders who are constitutionally guaranteed their payments ahead of any other payment, including salaries, vendors, rents, etc., have been stiffed. No one knows how things things will end up. But it won't be the investors receiving 100% of what they're due, even though those who bought dedicated streams of income. This should serve as a warning to investors contemplating bonds issued by Chicago in the months ahead. The Illinois state government recently passed its first budget in 3 years. Buried on page 711 of this monstrosity was a gift to the city of Chicago. The state granted authorities that operate under home rule, like Chicago, a separate or to segregate state funds. The Windy City receives about $1 billion in tax dollars from the state, generated by taxes and fees. Under the ruling, Chicago can put those funds in a separate account and issue bonds backed by the identified stream of income. The move allows the city to claim that the bonds are better, have better backing than simple general obligation bonds, which are backed in the full faith and credit of the town. This gives bonds backed by the segregated funds a higher rating and lower interest cost. It saves the city much needed cash. Here's a problem, though. Puerto Rico did the same thing with sales tax revenue. Now general tax obligation creditors claim that all income on the Commonwealth should be available to the entire creditor pool, including any dollars the Puerto Rican government self-segregated. It's a compelling case. Why should a city, Commonwealth, or state be allowed to identify dollars that won't be considered when calculating its full faith and credit? If Chicago follows the same path, the city will remove a significant portion of the funds that back any general obligation bond currently in existence. I think Chicago's default is just a matter of timing. When it happens, general obligation bondholders will go after every dollar available. Anyone buying newly issued bonds backed by the dedicated stream of state-collected tax revenue is taking a big leap of faith. The Illinois budget deal just happened, so there aren't any bonds in the works at the moment, but Mayor Emanuel would be foolish to not use every tool at his disposal for lowering financing costs for the city. Expect six bonds to hit the market in the next 6 months. Whether or not you roll the dice and buy them depends on how comfortable you are navigating near a black hole. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI, and we will be back shortly.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning on KGMI. As a reminder, if you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. And don't forget about our live show on Saturdays at 11 o'clock. We're on the air live. You can call us at the station if you got questions. More importantly, if you got things that you'd like to discuss, give us a call, set an appointment. We'd love to sit down with you. You know, we're bracing for the Fed's unprecedented bond sales. Effects from winding down a large portion of the Federal Reserve's record $4.5 trillion portfolio are expected to ripple across the financial markets. 9 years after the start of quantitative easing that left the Federal Reserve with a record $4.5 trillion balance sheet, market watchers are now speculating how the Fed's plans to start selling these bonds will hit the financial markets. While forecasts on the full impact of unwinding program that could start as early as September are all over the map, most observers agree that it's likely to ripple across most segments of the financial markets. The most important point is that this unwinding is really a big deal. People have gotten numb to extraordinary Fed action, but this has the potential to cause peculiar market reactions. The three rounds of Fed bond buying, which grew the Fed's balance sheet nearly sixfold between November of 2008 and October of 2014, is so unique that there are concerns that the unwinding will be felt across the stock and bond markets. The ultimate impact is not even conclusive on the interest rate side of things, because some people say it'll cause rates to go up, and others think it'll cause rates to go down. Economic logic suggests that interest rates will rise as the Fed starts selling bonds into the market. When the Fed was in the throes of bond buying binge, the yield on the 10-year Treasury bond was climbing in strides. So, who knows? The thought is, we're flooding the market with stimulus, so maybe taking that stimulus away will push rates down. But I think some people are worrying about the wrong market, because it's really equities where we should be more concerned. There was a stock market rally during each QE event, so I'm more convinced that stock market pulling back of the Fed starts to unwind. The Fed's current balance sheet, made up of $2.7 trillion in Treasury bonds, $1.8 million in mortgage-backed securities, was built up in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis as a means of boosting economic activity when it became clear that dropping interest rates to zero was not enough. At the start of the $1.75 trillion first round of the Fed bond buying between November 2008 and March of 2010, the Fed owned just $80 billion worth of bonds, which was about equal to the amount of currency in circulation at that time. Round 2 of QE between November 2010 and June of 2011 added another $600 billion to the Fed's portfolio. And Round 3 between September 12th and October 14th, 2014 added another $1.64 trillion. So the Fed's plan is to initially sell about $6 billion worth of bonds and $4 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities per month and gradually increase the amount it sells every 3 months. It is expected to take between 3 and 5 years to get the Fed's portfolio down to the targeted $2 trillion range, which would be equal to the amount of currency in circulation. The unwinding could be particularly hard on the mortgage market, considering the Fed currently owns about 20% of the mortgage-backed securities market. A lot of mortgage-backed securities are held by banks to meet liquidity requirements imposed on them by regulators. I think many of these investors are likely selling to rising rates to avoid taking the possible loss on their balance sheet and to avoid further price reductions. Right now, the yield curve is flat. That allows the Fed to accelerate unwinding at a quicker pace. I do think bond yields will move higher, but that's because it will help steepen the yield curve. The unwinding process will increase volatility across equity markets. If it doesn't, the volatility won't be enough to derail the upward potential of stocks. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here in September when the Fed finally decides to unwind or get rid of some of those bonds. Now, talk about a pathway to pro-growth, fiscally responsible tax reform. The tax code is in dire need of reform, but updating it is only one of the many items of Congress's agenda for the remainder of the year. Many fear that tax reform may lose out to other priorities. However, if Congress is serious about following through on its promise to the American people, it has several pathways to a pro-growth tax reform. In its current form, the U.S. tax saving is destructive to the economy and harms the well-being of every American. Congress should continue to work with the House GOP blueprint without the border adjustment tax as good foundation for reforming the U.S. tax code. The plan would encourage investment and work in entrepreneurship and would promote the growth of the economy, not its destruction. Pro-growth tax reform that provides relief for American families and businesses, however, faces political and procedural barriers to success. It is unlikely that the standalone bill subject to the 60-vote threshold in the Senate will gain sufficient support for passage. Most political observers see reconciliation as the most likely path for reform, and the reconciliation process enables Congress to fast-track reform in the Senate, limiting debate and lowering the necessary vote threshold to a simple majority instead of requiring 60 votes. Hopefully John McCain is listening here. If used correctly, reconciliation can strengthen the permanency of the reform and increase the efforts of probability of success. And reconciliation provides a route for the passage of tax reform. Members of Congress must pursue debt reduction or deficit neutrality in order to avoid a point of order against the reconciliation bill. Two rules pose a potential threat to tax reform if the proposed package increases deficits: the pay-as-you-go or pay-go rule and the Byrd rule. The Senate pay-as-you-go rule requires that any legislation that decreases revenues must also include spending cuts, revenue increases, or a combination of the two to remain deficit neutral. The Senate can waive this rule in its budget resolution if it chooses. The Byrd rule, which is specific to the reconciliation process, requires that reconciliation must not increase the deficit outside the budget window. Waiving this rule is not so easy. Doing so requires 60 votes in the Senate. The rules of reconciliation require deficit neutrality, not revenue neutrality. So by combining reforms that phase in over several years to mandatory spending with tax reforms, Congress can proof its reconciliation bill because the procedural barriers to enactment. This keeps reformers from chasing higher revenues through counterproductive proposals such as border adjustments. Congress could also include instructions in the budget resolution for a longer budget window of 20 years or more rather than the traditional 10-year period. A Byrd rule point of order would still pertain to the outside years, but a longer window could also allow more gradual spending reforms and additional tax savings. So, Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI this Sunday morning. I thank you for listening. Got questions for us? Give us a call. 360-733-1200. Have a good week.